There's a whole lot of things I want to tell you about. Adventures, dangerous and queer. Some you could guess, and some I've only hinted at. So please lend me your ear.
Everyone has a relationship with gender. What's your story? Hello and welcome to Gender Stories with your host, Dr. Alex Yantafi.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Gender Stories. As ever, I'm delighted, I'm excited. I know I say it every time, but I truly am every time to be here with Eli Conley today. Eli is an indie folk singer-songwriter, teaching artist, and activist based on Miwok Nisenan land, currently known as Sacramento, California. He makes music for queer and trans folks, justice seekers, and anyone who doesn't fit easily in a box. Eli's voice is tender and heartfelt, with melodies that can leave you teary-eyed, yet hopeful. As a queer transgender man from the South, his songs tell stories that aren't always reflected in roots music. Eli founded Queer Country West Coast, a regular series featuring LGBTQ plus blues, folk, and country artists in California. He has opened for Kirstie Blanton, Heather May, and Grammy winner Kimia Dawson, and been featured in the Huffington Post and The Advocate. Eli's third album, Searching for What's True, is coming in July 2023, and it has themes of uncertainty, ache and loss that come up again and again. The songs are drawn from the concrete and immediate details of daily life, a stuffed animal clutching a child's arms, a colorful sunset after a forest fire, a Confederate statue toppling to the ground. Searching for What's True is Eli's first release since being diagnosed with a serious repetitive stress injury that forced him to stop playing music for many months. After resurgery and careful rehab, he came back to songwriting with a renewed sense of purpose. On the album's first single, Making Something New, he describes the work of an artist as finding beauty in the wreckage, making meaning of the grief. When we tell our stories true, we find release. His deep belief in the transformative power of creativity stems not only from his own experiences, but his many years leading singing and songwriting classes for queer and transgender people and allies. And in fact, Eli and I met at the Trans Voices Festival back in Minneapolis, where you were both performing and teaching a lovely workshop. And then I took most of one of your classes, and then I, like, life got too much and my health got a little bit too much, so I had to drop off. But it's been so wonderful to see you perform and also see you teach. You truly have such a love of nurturing creativity in others, I think, that is really infectious. And so yeah, I'm really excited that you're here on Gender Stories. Thank you.
Yeah, Alex, thank you so much. It's really good to be here with you and get to connect with you in this way. I really loved having you as a student and now getting to be on the interviewee side with you.
Absolutely. I want to really start from that sentence, actually, of finding beauty in the wreckage that it's in one of your songs. And at the moment, there's a lot of wreckage, I think, for trans folks. And so what does that kind of... where does that line come from, and how do you find that beauty in the wreckage at the moment in your life?
You know, that line is in the title song of the album. The album's called Searching for What's True, and the song is called Making Something New. And it comes from the bridge that was not in the song originally, but I was kind of writing this song, playing with the idea of the connections between the way that artists are, you know, grappling with creativity in lots of different ways and the way that queer and trans folks are also, like, I think, inherently creative, because when you have realized who you are in a world that tells you you're one thing, and then you're like, wait a minute, actually, the truth about my gender and sexuality is something else, I think it can open us up to realizing that, like, so many things are up for grabs, and we can, like, create ourselves and create a lot of beautiful things. So to come back to your question, I think one way that I grapple with the work that is my work as a artist, both a teaching artist and a performing artist right now, is that actually when times are really rough is one of the times that we need beauty and we need art the most. We need things that are going to lift us up and help remind us that we are human and that we are more than just, you know, what the right wing and the media is saying we are as queer and trans folks or as marginalized folks broadly, because we know we're not the only ones mm-hmm. under attack. And so for me, certainly my creative practice is part of how I actually create that space within my life, do deep self-care for myself and through exploring like, okay, what is something that is really exciting or beautiful or compelling for me right now? And I also see that in my community, like reminding myself when I kind of get the tunnel vision of, you know, scrolling on the screen or looking at the news, which I tried to, you know, do in measured amounts.
Yes.
Actually being like, who is in my life? What is the care and love and like beautiful queerness and joy that is around me all the time? If I just kind of open my eyes up to the people who are close to me, even when we're struggling, that's a lot of the place that like I personally find a lot of joy.
Ah, that's beautiful. I love that. And I think we do need joy more than ever, even though in the album, which I had the privilege to kind of get a little preview of, and I'm so excited. There are a lot of themes of loss and pain. And I do wonder how much of that has come out of, you know, we've been in a pandemic for 3 years. There's also been kind of an epidemic and an uprising. And for a moment, it looked like maybe even a shift towards, abolition, you know, mm-hmm. and that kind of died down. And then you also dealt individually with chronic health issues. And so how much kind of all those things kind of informed the album as well?
Yeah. So I really started writing this record 18. So kind of pre-pandemic, mm-hmm. but post-Trump, just to place it in time. Yes. Yeah. we were definitely dealing with fascism. We were not yet dealing with COVID-19. Because my last record was in 2017, and this is really a culmination of what I think are the best songs that I've written in the past number of years. But through that time in 2019, I got this repetitive stress injury in both my wrists, actually from being on tour and just playing gigs that were, you know, 2 hours long to make money. Sometimes I'll play background music gigs. And I came home and I was in a lot of pain that I'd been ignoring, but I finally went to the doctor and was diagnosed with this, it's called de Quervain's syndrome, mm-hmm. similar to carpal tunnel, but like on the other side of the wrist. And basically at that time I had to completely stop playing guitar, and I teach voice. My kind of day job is I'm a voice teacher, also teach songwriting. And I also had to take some time off from playing piano and teaching voice. And so I kind of had this vacuum suddenly that a lot of people had in 2020 when like their livelihood, mm-hmm. particularly those of us who are not essential workers, was taken away or really shifted. But for me in 2019, suddenly I was in this big question of, who am I if I'm not making music? Mm. Who am I if I'm not able to play instruments? And I was really a singer first before I ever came to being an instrumentalist. But, you know, I've had some journeys with my voice as a trans person. And in that moment, one of the ways that I started writing music is I actually came back to voice-only songs. I wrote some songs inspired by the uprising in 2020. My friend Talia Cooper and I wrote a song called It's Gonna Come to Me. Nope, it's gone. I'll think of it later.
But you wrote a song.
Yeah, we wrote a song yes. kind of specifically calling out to fellow white folks around taking action for the movement for Black Lives, that was like a call and response song. And coming back to kind of writing voice only songs is a really powerful way to realize like, I'm always going to be a musician. I'm always going to be a songwriter. You know, I've learned a lot from disability justice movement and friends with disabilities that like we are not, you know, our productivity, right? Or like our bodies mm-hmm. and the way we use our bodies and the ways that we need care is going to shift for all of us over our lifetime. But that was a quick moment of change for me. And so I think the songs that I wrote post having to take time off from making music physically with an instrument, like they did kind of have this different urgency or like weight to them. There's a song on the record called I Don't Want to Hurt that I wrote around the Oakland Hills just almost kind of scream singing, I don't want to hurt anymore. And eventually when I was able to come back to guitar with help from wrist surgery and hand therapy, and, you know, very careful playing, I'm still very careful these days. Mm-hmm. I was able to add guitar underneath them. But yeah, I will also say even prior to 2018, I've been a kind of serious, sad songwriter, but maybe the time's caught up with my art. I don't really know. There's also a song about queer astronauts. So, you know, you never know.
I know. I kind of love that. I was listening and I was like, is this song about queer astronauts? And I was like, yes, yes, it is. It is about queer astronauts.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I can go there. This is great. But it was kind of, yes, you usually have so much more kind of everyday moments,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They took me a minute. I was like, we're in space. Okay.
Yeah.
It just seemed to diverge a little from your canon.
It's,
you know what
very,
I mean?
It's very unexpected. Your average folk song is not about astronauts. But, you know, sometimes those things come true. I tried really hard to make it a metaphor for something. And the astronauts in the song were just like, nope, we are just gay astronauts in space. And I was like, all right. I'm going to let you be who you are right now.
Oh my God, I love that, because actually just recently I've had so many conversations about how so many trans folks love science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, me too.
You know, and I've just been to, right? I've just been at WISCON, which is the feminist science fiction convention.
Nice.
That has been happening for like 46 years. I mean, yeah, this was WISCON 46. And I think there is something about space and the possibilities of space that have inspired a lot of trans queer folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was actually delightful that there's a song about queer astronauts in your album. I thought it was great.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, my very first record, I had a song about a mythological Greek siren, like leaving her perch on the rocks to go be a rock star. Mm-hmm. I think just for whatever reason, I like have little bits of speculative stuff kind of come in here and there. And actually there's this book that I love. Let me look up the title of it on my bookshelf.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you've read it. It's called Meanwhile Elsewhere, but it's specifically all short stories, speculative fiction by trans and non-binary authors. Highly recommend it.
Nice.
Meanwhile Elsewhere.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to write it down.
It's so good. And my favorite author is actually Ursula Le Guin. I've read almost everything by her. But
she's the best.
It's, you know, I think as a queer and trans person who like makes country and folk music, sometimes people think there's like a big clash between those two things, that they can't coexist. And in a way, it almost feels similar of like, who says you can't write a folk song about queer astronauts? You know, there's queer people in the future. There's queer people in the past. Like all of these things can coexist at the same time. Yeah. And I think that's one of the beautiful things actually about being a songwriter. It's a little bit like being a poet, where each piece you're making is actually pretty short. And then you gather them together mm-hmm. into this bigger thing. But it's very different from writing, say, a novel or, I don't know, a movie. Like I can kind of, when I'm crafting a set and I'm playing live, think about like, okay, I'll have the tearjerkers, but like, let me have a moment of lightness or a moment of levity mm-hmm. in the middle and kind of, I think sometimes people are like not sure if they're allowed to laugh at my shows, but I'll be like, no, this song is intentionally funny. You are allowed
it's
to
like
laugh.
You don't have to be sad.
Yeah. Like I take it as a compliment when people cry at my music, but also mm-hmm. there will be moments of like, hopefully joy and laughter too.
I love that. And you mentioned a little bit as well that you know, you had your own journeys as a trans artist and singer, especially with your voice. And I know that actually that is something that a lot of trans folks who are singers or really enjoy their voice, especially if they're going from an estrogen dominant body to a testosterone dominant body, they worry, right, about that impact on singing voice. Or, you know, if they're younger folks who are testosterone dominant wanting to move to an estrogen dominant mm-hmm. body, you know, puberty suppression is so important to preserve that kind of higher pitch voice.
That's right.
That otherwise kind of testosterone is going to change. And so in either direction, I think that there's concerns around voice. If you want to, could you share a little bit about your journey and what helped you mm-hmm. kind of with journeying through the changes in your voice?
So I transitioned almost 17 years ago which is kind of wild, but in 2006, I was 20. And at the time, pretty much all the information out there said you take testosterone and you can't sing anymore. Just like period.
Yeah, I remember.
All the stuff I could find, both anecdotally and, you know, just on whatever it was, LiveJournal at the time. This was even pre-YouTube days. Not that I'm that old.
Oh, yeah. That's about the time when I started transitioning to actually. That was the same all the information generation. Was like. Yeah, I think you're a little younger.
Right. No, I mean, but same transition or, you know, trans generation. Yes. Yeah. I know it's weird. The generation's like, when did you come out? How old are you?
I was like, we're the same trans age, but I think you're younger than me.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Years.
I'm 37. But yeah, so I transitioned in college. And my journey in a nutshell was I kind of was realizing that I was not a girl in high school and initially sort of came out as genderqueer, what we might call non-binary today. And then it was really important to me when I decided to start hormones and eventually have top surgery to kind of make those decisions independent of identity in a way. And like eventually I did start identifying as male, but I didn't, it was really politically and personally important to me that it wasn't just like, well, I'm a dude, so I'm going to take tea and have top surgery. It was like, you know, each of these things is an independent decision that is related. But I put off hormones for maybe a year because of fear around my voice changing, because I was very identified as a singer, grew up singing my whole life. I was taking, I was not a voice major, but I was taking voice lessons at the school where I went, and knew I wanted to be a performer in a serious way. And I'm very thankful that as I transitioned, I had a couple other students who were like opera majors at the school where I went in Ohio who worked with me. And they'd never worked with trans folks, but they were just like, well, I can be an outside ear and like help listen and track your range as it changes. And for whatever reason, I think maybe a combination of being young and also that I was exercising my voice really all through that change. Like it was challenging. Took a couple of years to fully settle, but I was able to go from like high soprano to eventually high tenor and keep singing. And that's a big reason that I became a voice teacher after college is because we needed so many more resources around singing and testosterone and specifically, but also singing and gender and trans and non-binary folks more broadly. And I wanted to be a resource around that. And now it's 17 years later, and I've worked with probably hundreds of trans and non-binary singers through transition and, you know, plenty of folks who are not transitioning. Like it looks very different for everybody, but the working with folks who are on testosterone or thinking about it is a big piece of my work as a teacher. And honestly, I've had some vocal challenges in the last 4 or 5 years, and I don't know if they're related to long-term testosterone or not. We don't have research on long-term effects of hormones on professional singers. If you are listening and you want to do that research, please do. We need it. But I'll say that in the past few years, I learned a new teaching technique that involved changing a little bit and doing a little more what's called belting, which is using your kind of speaking range up higher. I tried to do some of that on my own and I kind of tied myself in some knots. But thankfully, I've been working with the teacher who created this technique to like get through that and on the other side. So all that is to say, my voice today is like not as easy and effortless as it was when I was 15 or even when I was 25 post-T. But it feels a lot better than it did 5 years ago. And I think also like aging changes our voice, right? It's another way that like I feel like I try to learn from my friends and comrades with disabilities and just be like, you know what? I can't count on my body being the same day to day. And like, how do I love my body and be with it as it is and like make art in the moment with what I have rather than kind of wishing for some sort of ideal voice or something. But I think it's honestly made me a better teacher because singing is not as effortless as it used to be. I do have to like work and warm up and, you know, be more thoughtful about how I use my voice these days.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I have friends who are singers, like professional singers, and who are older. you know, I'm in my 50s. I have a friend who was in her 60s, mm-hmm. and she talked about how her voice is changing, and it is more effortful to perform, also mm-hmm. to do concerts. You know, still a beautiful voice, but like just the care
yep.
that we need to put into our body as we get older, always. Mm-hmm. And then if we're disabled, I think it's a little bit extra effort. But I love how your journey really speaks to just that creativity of trans folks that you were talking about at the beginning, right? You were like, yeah, this makes me nervous. You know, you waited, but then you're like, okay, we're doing this. And you recruited people who could support you. And then you took all those things that you've learned and really put them into supporting people. Because, yeah, I remember, you know, in the early to mid 2000, there was just nothing in terms of resources, yeah. Both for myself, but I also had clients as a therapist who were like, what about my yep. voice? And I was like, oh, you can go to a speech and language therapist, but I don't really know what's going to happen to your singing voice, mm-hmm. right? If there was a love of singing. And I really think it speaks to our creativity that there are actually so many trans singers and artists who have navigated those changes.
Totally.
In every direction, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think there are so many people in so many different genres too. You know, I think about Venus, the Mars mm-hmm, here mm-hmm. in Minnesota was much more like, I don't know if she would say punk rock.
Definitely rock. Yeah.
I'm not very good with my music genre sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, but all the way to like, you know, more folk and country. And I just love that we really have so many trans and non-binary singers now.
Yeah.
Compared to like 20 years ago, I don't remember having trans singers having this much visibility. Do you when you first came out?
Yeah, when I was first coming out 20 years ago, in those early years, there was Josh Klipp, who's like a kind of crooner jazz singer in San Francisco. Yeah. And there was Joe Stevens, who I now am friends with. He lives in Sacramento. And he was in a band called Coyote Grace, who are more sort of my genre, like Americana mm-hmm. country folk. Storm Miguel Flores, who's also a kind of Americana songwriter in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But, you know, I moved to the Bay and that's where all those people were. And so I met them because it's a small world. And
absolutely. Yeah. I'm looking at a Coyote Grace.
They're so good.
I was like, I literally have a poster across from my desk.
Well, that was so meaningful, right? Like, I think for folks who maybe weren't out or are younger, might not know, mm-hmm. like at the time, finding an out trans singer and especially somebody who was like on testosterone and like singing professionally was like huge. And Coyote Grace, you know, people would travel for hours to go see their shows in the early 2000s mm-hmm. because it was like, oh my gosh, this couple, like queer cis femme and like trans guy who are like making music about this experience and like being open about that. I really feel like they paved the way, or made the path is maybe a better word for folks like me who came a little bit after. And I think like in the generations of like queer and trans artists, right? Like each of us by stepping into our power and sharing our art is making space for who comes after us. And so much gratitude to them. And it's not like they're gone. They're still making music to this day.
Yeah.
Ingrid mm-hmm. Elizabeth from that band is now in a band called Mouths of Babes. That's really awesome. Joe Stevens is mm-hmm. writing musicals. Just the like, we can count them on one hand, probably the people who were like in the public eye at that time. And now I feel like mm-hmm. every day, I'm finding out about more queer and transitions. And that's just like really beautiful to me. Like I still have students who come to me and are like, I don't even know what a trans singer could sound like. Like, what could my voice be? But, you know, you can go to Spotify and find like a bunch of playlists of trans singers, which is like, always we need more and we need more, folks kind of reaching the mainstream because you have to dig a little mm-hmm. deeper. But, I'm really thankful as somebody who has been doing this work for a minute, that I don't feel as alone anymore, either as a voice teacher specializing in trans voice, and also as a performer. Like both of those things, I find I have a lot more community these days in that work. And it also makes me feel maybe counterintuitively, like I don't always have to center transness in everything I do because there's like enough people doing this work that I get to be a more nuanced human a little bit, which is like also nice, honestly, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I relate to that so much because I remember even, you know, as a family therapist, not a lot about trans family therapists 20 years ago, you know, at one point, I think I was the only out trans clinical supervisor that I knew in family therapy, right? And now there are so many people, I was like, I don't even have to talk about gender anymore when I present. Right. I'll just talk about disability or something else.
Yeah.
Because there's more people, right? Whereas before it's like, always like, can you do it? You know, trans 101 of some kind, and it does get a little tiring. And so it's so wonderful that there are so many more people, exactly, and you don't have to kind of center that so much. Mm-hmm. Although I do think that you do still really value sharing stories, not just about yourself, but about trans folks, you know. And one of the songs in your new album is "Hey, That's Me." Mm-hmm. Right. And that could speak, I think, to so many different aspects of the trans experience.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you want to share a little bit more about that song, but also what does it mean for you to be a trans and out trans artist with many people in your audience, your listeners who are also trans, although not exclusively, of course.
Yeah. That would be kind of wild if only trans people listen to me.
Amazing. Trans only concert.
You can only see me. It's like that. What is the filter on OkCupid? Like, I don't want to be seen by straight people. Probably. That's where I met my husband. I was not on the swiping apps. But yeah, question was about, hey, that's me. This is a song that I wrote thinking about actually a young non-binary trans musician who I know who was first kind of coming out, first starting testosterone. And I was just thinking about, like, you know, I have been out for almost 20 years at that point. Now it has been 20 years. And like, what did I want to say to somebody who is in that position in a similar age as I was in college when they were like coming out? And so the first verse is kind of addressing, it says like, there may come a time when your body don't feel easy. And in order to be free, it has to change. There may come a time when your gender, it just fractures and you have to take some action, rearrange. And I really wanted to speak to that, just like, this may happen to you at some point, you know, like, and it can be something that is really surprising, but like, if you are in that moment, it's also a chance to share with the world, with people and with yourself, like who you really are, who you're finding out yourself to be. And so in that first chorus, "Hey, that's me," is kind of like, hey, that's who I always hoped that I would be. I'm like finally getting to show that to the world, figuring it out for myself. I think a lot of those of us, whether it's social transition, medical transition, like, transition can look so different, and also not all trans people do transition, right? But when you step into that moment of kind of saying, I am going to shift how I present myself, maybe what pronouns I use, it can be this beautiful moment of recognition. They're sort of the like iconic image of a trans person looking themselves in the mirror, right? But like, it's iconic because it's also true that when you start to actually outwardly express who you are more so, there's like a joy in that recognition. And then the second verse talks specifically about voice and what happens if you do find your voice kind of unrecognizable or like the difficulty of singing songs that maybe were really familiar to you. This person I was writing to was a songwriter. And speaking from my personal experience, both as someone who had gone through vocal change and then at the time I was writing the song was kind of grappling newly with whether it's aging or how I was using my voice, things not coming as easily. And so in that one, "Hey, That's Me" is kind of being like, hey, this is what I've tried to do, you know, like tried to keep singing and find my way to loving my voice even through all the changes. And then the last verse is about kind of eventually as we get older, I use this metaphor of like holding out your umbrella for the young. And not that I'm that old, you know, I'm not quite middle-aged yet. But at the same time, it does sometimes feel like trans generations are like 5 years long. You know, it was like we were the live journal generation. And then there was the Tumblr and YouTube generation. And like now it's probably the TikTok generation. But the way that as you do become, you know, old, been out for longer, it is an opportunity to like create space and care for folks who are coming behind you. and kind of speaking to this person and being like, you're going to be in my shoes someday. 20 years from now, you will have been out for 20 years and you can like care for young folks. And so that's also for myself thinking as I become older, like that's how I hope that I continue to be. So yeah, through writing that song, I got to grapple a lot with thinking about queer generations and aging and what it means to both be not that old, but not that young anymore either. You know, I am coming into middle age at a particular time when also transness is under the microscope in a way that it really wasn't when I was first coming out.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in a way, that kind of trans tipping point, you know, if we go with that iconic
Laverne Cox cover,
cover of Laverne Cox, exactly. Yes, more visibility, but also kind of visibility sometimes makes you a target. And it, in a way, it feels like people know a lot more. And it, in some ways, there is a lot more ease. And in other ways, there's also a lot more, a lot more fear, a lot more stress, I think, for a lot of us. But it is wild to think that, oh, hang on, when I came out as trans, it was 20 years ago or 20 plus years ago. Where did the time go? Absolutely. Yeah, it's it goes so fast and so slow all at the same time, and also this idea of trans time.
Yeah.
Like I said, right? It's like I'm 52, you're younger, but at the same time, we're kind of very similar trans generation because of when we came out. Right, even though I was like over 10 years older than
it's
you.
It's real.
Yes.
Yeah, I really, yeah, my husband came out. I don't know, maybe 8 years ago now, and just being like, oh yeah, how you were accessing support groups and everything, you didn't have to call a phone number to like get the address of where you were gonna go, which was so scary. I remember like a shout out to Compass in Boston, Massachusetts, calling and being like, can I come to your meeting? Where is it? I guess I have to call someone and tell them that I'm trans.
Oh my God, that's real. I mean, when I first came out as queer almost 30 years ago, when I remember standing outside, you know, the gay pub in this kind of smallish town in the UK, just wanting to go in, but not knowing how to do it, you know, like, how do you do this, you know? And I stood outside that pub so many times before I managed to like go inside because it would, you know, there just wasn't a lot else, you know, 30 years ago when you first came out. It was like paper ads and, you know, there was like one cafe in London that was queer, which was wonderful. Unfortunately, it's closed down since. And, you know, and then there were, you know, gay and lesbian pubs. That's kind of what we had and where you went to meet community and find people.
I remember standing outside
total different ball
the
game.
Gay bookstore in Richmond, Virginia, where I'm from, as like a teenager and just being like, I really want Stone Butch Blues. I feel like they probably have it there, but I never was able to go in. My friend loaned me his copy, bless him, later on. But
I
didn't have, you know, Powell's to order from.
No, there was no online ordering or, you know, it was a lot harder. Yes, absolutely. And talking about, you know, we're talking about cross-generational, in a way, connection in trans community, that in your album, there's also cross-movement solidarity, as well as kind of intergenerational stories. That's this cross-movement solidarity. And one of the songs is We Keep Each Other Safe. And I would love to hear from you a little bit more about what inspired you to write that song. Why did it feel important to include the song in your album?
So We Keep Each Other Safe is a song that like imagines a world without police. Like, what would safety look like in a world where we actually did have community-based safety and not this white supremacist militarized force, right? State-funded force of violence. And it's not like I, on my own, obviously, I actually wrote it through, so very much inspired by the protests in 2020 and the politics that have pre-existed that for a long time that have been led by Black women around the abolition of policing and prisons more broadly. I was really radicalized around that in college from my professor at Oberlin, Pam Brooks, who taught a class called, I think it was like the History of Black Folks and Incarceration. And we read both Angela Davis's autobiography and her book, Are Prisons Obsolete? And I just like, you know, completely had my mind exploded, and was like, yeah, this is what we need. We need to abolish the prison industrial complex and like such a pillar of white supremacy that needs to fall, mm-hmm. In order for us to live in a world that works best for us all. Right. And so in 2020, or maybe, I think it was summer 2020, the organization Showing Up for Racial Justice, which organizes white mm-hmm. folks around working in solidarity with people of color led struggles for justice, put out a call to white artists to make work specifically inviting more white people into racial justice movements broadly, and specifically mm-hmm. the calls to defund and abolish the police that obviously was coming out of the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. They put out a wonderful toolkit that you can still find online, White Artists for Racial Justice, and gathered a bunch of artists across disciplines and across the country. And in the music group, we read through all the prompts together and wrote songs and like gave each other feedback, which I think is so important, especially when we're doing political work, to really like, you know, be sharing it in a community of like-minded artists who we can bounce things off of and say, that doesn't land quite right. Or like, oh yeah, this is great. Keep going. And so ultimately this song came out of that project. And I really intended it to be this like tone of joyful invitation to mm-hmm. white folks like me to come in and say, you know what, we can actually transform the structures that our ancestors created. We have that within our power to join Black-led movements for justice. And like, how would our lives be better if we lived in a world where like, if somebody comes in and steals stuff in your house, they don't mm-hmm. just get whisked away and like basically disappeared by the state into prison, right? But what would happen if there was a community safety team who actually showed up mm-hmm. and was like, oh, you need money to help feed your kids. Let's help you get the resources you need so that your family has what they need. You can pay this person back for what mm-hmm. you stole. But more importantly, and like that's important, right? And also like you won't have to do this again because you'll have what you need. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes abolition can feel like this huge sort of amorphous abstract concept. But when we actually really ground it in like, okay, well, what is another possibility for what we would do in an instance of harm that actually wouldn't just harm the person who created harm even more, but create a situation where like we could actually have some kind of justice that was real and not just revenge. Mm-hmm. And that was a beautiful challenge. Do that in a, you know, 3.5 minute song. When we played in the studio, I think at first the musicians were like trying to play very somber. And I was like, no, like I've written a lot of sad and angry songs about white supremacy. And like, there's a reason for that. But like, song is actually intended to be like, we can build a better world. And like white people, like we can be a part of that. We don't have to kind of either just stand on the sideline watching or be actively racist. Like we can actually participate in struggles against racism because like, it allows us to access our humanity much more deeply when we remember that we're not just white, that we're like humans, mm-hmm. right? And we've been constructed as white and we have privilege from that. But mm-hmm. there is so much that we can gain from being a part of solidarity across movements. And I think especially queer and trans folks, like we have that opportunity, of mm-hmm. course, to see like we are marginalized in this culture. So we see the ways that the mainstream kind of constructs power and creates literal policies that are impacting our bodies that are harming us, and to actually open up to like, oh, we're not the only people in this position. It might look a little different. Mm-hmm. But there are so many different people who are being harmed in this culture and this system. So like, how do we actually band together? And also obviously acknowledge there's lots of Black and people of Indigenous and people of color who are also queer and trans who like can lead us and mm-hmm. tell us, you know, from their position and what their knowledge is. But I come from a kind of community organizing background, and my work mm-hmm. as an artist in the beginning, I always would kind of be like, well, how can I do this? How can I like not be doing all my time on organizing? Like being an artist is selfish. But eventually I realized like artists are deeply a part of creating culture, and culture shift is like such a necessary part of the changes that we need. It's not either or, it really mm-hmm. is both and. And like, this is what lights me up, and I'm still absolutely a part of organizations like Surge, but like the work that I feel most deeply called to do is arts-based.
Mm-hmm. And that transformative work is so important because I think it is hard for a lot of people to imagine post-abolitionist mm-hmm. world, like a world, you know, I remember even as a young person being, an abolitionist, not only a police, but kind of political orders. Yeah. And people are like, you're young and idealistic. Mm-hmm. You'll change your mind. How is that possible? Right. And then luckily I found that there was a whole movement for abolition, yeah. Which was really great to plug in as a teenager. But and now I'm in my 50s and I can be like, nope, never outgrown yep. it. This wasn't just some wild fantasy, that people around me were like, this is a wild fantasy, And I was like, it's actually not. Mm-mm. A lot of Black scholars have thought about mm-hmm. it. A lot of Indigenous scholars have thought mm-hmm. about it. And it is possible, but it's going to take a huge cultural shift
yeah.
because it's going to be so much more based in community and relating and connecting, mm-hmm. right? And we live in, living under capitalism and white supremacists. It's all about disconnect
yeah.
and separation. And so I think it's so important to have songs and books and poetry and fiction that really, and science mm-hmm. fiction and speculative fiction that invites us to imagine, just a different way of existing and a different way of relating. Mm-hmm. I could talk about that for a long time. So that's why I was like, oh, I want to talk about that song because you have a lot of themes, but I think that it's worth highlighting that there is that cross movement mm-hmm. solidarity that's pretty central, I think.
Oh,
to
yeah,
your work.
Totally. Totally. Totally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like I could have this conversation forever and I want to be respectful of your time. So one of the last things I wanted to talk about was inspired by one of the songs on the new mm-hmm. album as well, Let Them See. And I was really thinking about this piece around mm-hmm. visibility and how visibility can be so complicated, I think, for a lot of us who are mm-hmm. minoritized and especially for trans folks. And so, yeah, I was curious about what's your relationship with visibility as an out trans artist. And also, you've been open about your journey with chronic health issues on social media. You're openly involved with dismantling white supremacy, with including songs like We Keep Each Other Safe. So yeah, what's your relationship with visibility and how has that changed maybe over
yeah.
the years?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up in relation to that song, Let Them See Me, because it's actually, I wrote it. That's mm-hmm. one song on the album that I wrote, not by myself. I wrote it with my friend Pamela Makala. And we were kind of thinking about, as artists, like the kind of, I have a student who calls it the mortifying ordeal of being perceived. I know you're a therapist, so
oh,
I'm sure
yes.
you like, yeah,
that
right?
Are
you still thinking about that? Like, I really want to be seen and yeah. I hate being seen, right? Like, and we were kind of thinking of it in that place of like, and we wrote it on Zoom during the pandemic. So when we weren't performing also, mm-hmm. Being like, do we want to be seen again? Like, what does it mean to be seen in all your vulnerability when you're like, not sure you're as quote unquote mm-hmm. good as other people or that what you're making is actually valuable, but to actually frame it in terms of like queer and trans visibility. It's really interesting because that is something that I think about a lot is like, I'm very out as an artist and as a teacher. I teach like music classes for queer and trans folks and allies. I really want queer and trans people to be able to find me and my work both as a teacher and as an artist. Mm-hmm. And not every song I write is like a gay song, I don't actually know that playing at like a big city pride stage is like the best venue mm-hmm. for my work. Like I'm a kind of sensitive songwriter who makes you cry, and like, so, certainly yes. shout out to the like country and folk queers who have a tear in their beer in the back of the folk club or whatever. Like that's my people. but I think I do also want to be creating work that is like resonant with people through and beyond queer and trans communities. And I think I am people definitely could be about my work, not only relating to queer and trans themes, but about the like many themes that I cover. I think it's easy to be pigeonholed as an artist in a certain way. And yet at the same time, right now it feels all the more important to me to like be making art that is unapologetically queer and trans, and be like kind of creating those moments of reflection and beauty and the word that's coming to my head is recreation, which is not exactly what I mean, but you know, like joy for queer and trans folks, because this maybe speaks to the solidarity piece too. Like, I deeply, deeply believe that when queer and trans people are free, everybody is more free. Just like Fannie Lou Hamer, civil rights organizer, said, right? Nobody's free until everybody's free. And so I think my work of becoming more free as a queer and trans man is actually something that creates possibility for everybody to be more free. And by making work that sometimes centers queer and trans experience, because that is my experience, it allows people to kind of, if they're not from our community, like see my experience from the inside in a different way. But by also making work that's about chronic pain, right? Or about losing my grandmother, or about the imagining a world without police. Those are also ways, like things that are relevant to queer and trans people. We're all going to deal with losing people. We're all going to deal with living in this world structured as it is. And so I actually don't see them as like separate, kind of the like visibility as an artist, period, and visibility as a queer and trans person. Obviously, like you said, it can be a double-edged sword where we can become a target when we are more visible in the world. But I also think the backlash from the fascists is like, because we actually are so powerful that they are afraid of us. That's why they're trying to get, you know, tucking underwear taken out of Target, right? It's because like actually trans people having access to bodily autonomy is a like radical, beautiful thing that's becoming more mainstream, right? And so I think that's the thing I try to remember is that when we feel that huge movement against us, it's a reaction to our power. It's not a sign that we need to back down. It's actually a sign that we need to like keep moving forward and being our like beautiful, freaky, queer and trans selves in as many ways as we possibly can, and like lifting each other up. And I guess that's what I think about visibility right now.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, and, you know, and I really think that when we, you know, that's the thing about writing, right? In general, we can speak from our experience, but there is something that often touches people that have a completely different experience, right? It's like, I think that's the power of writing, whether it's writing a book, writing a song, writing a poem, or even like a painting, right? We can go from such a specific experience, but then there is something that touches other people. And I love what you said about our power, because in a way, we are powerful as queer and trans folks in terms of body autonomy, right? And I think that fascists are very scared of body autonomy, right? I remember being at my oldest kid's school when she was little, and this tiny young person, you know, maybe 6 or 7 year old, was like, "Are you a boy?" And I was like, "No." "Are you a girl?" And I was like, "No." And they were like, "You've got to be one." And I was like, "I actually don't." "Do you know that you can decide who you are?" And I was like, "I'm a bit of a girl and a bit of a boy, both or neither, you know, you could, depending on the day." And they were just like, "Okay." You know, when you could see the little like gears, you know, going. And I was like, when you were talking about that, I had that memory and I thought, yes, we are a threat to fascism, because in a way it's like, if we can have this body autonomy, if we can have this freedom to be ourselves, who else is going to question, right? Control. And fascism is all about control. And so if we, body autonomy is the opposite, I think, of control in a way. So yeah. And I think that then when you add being an artist on top of being trans and queer, that's even more of a threat, because now you're not only have body autonomy, but you're inviting people into this whole other world of creativity, right? Which is also a threat. I don't know. Just
I love those thoughts. And as somebody who's from Italy and in your 50s, like, you know a thing or two about fascism, I know.
I mean, I was brought up with like stories of fascism, you know, my grandmother, my school teacher was very alive, they're not wanting to go back there. Unfortunately, it seems that people have forgotten in my country.
I know.
So yeah. Do you have the time to sing a song for your press? That'd be great. Given that we've been talking about your songs and Let Them See, I would love if you had the capacity for it, for you to sing.
Okay.
Gotta put on a full face of makeup. Gotta match my earrings to my belt. I gotta style my hair just right. Squeeze into heels that feel so tight. I gotta be better than myself. Scroll my phone while making breakfast. Perfect pictures flashing by. I choose a filter for my post. I pick the one that hides the most. Trying to look better than myself. Don't let them see me, 'cause I don't think that I would measure up. Don't let them see me, 'cause being me is never quite enough. I sit down at the table with my notebook and my pen. If I write what's on my heart, will people care about my art? Wish I could be better than myself. Can I let them see me when I don't think that I would measure up? Can I let them see me when being me is never quite enough? What if I died and no one ever saw me? Would I have been here at all? What if the cost of staying hidden is greater than the risk? Only the folks who never fly, never fall, gonna let them see me. What if I measure up? Gonna let them see me, 'cause being me is actually enough. Being me is actually enough.
What a beautiful way to end. Now you got me teary-eyed. For people who are listening and not watching, I'm like, yep, Eli did it.
I didn't hear you, but I think you said something about crying.
Yeah, I was like, for folks who are not watching the video, I'm like, I'm definitely teary-eyed, you know, if they're listening only. Well, thank you. That is so beautiful. Oh, like, I love your songs, and what a treat to have you share one of your songs with our listeners. Thank you. I know we're wrapping up. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you really wanted to share with people or not? And if not, that's okay. I just say
the record Searching for What's True comes out July 14th on all the streaming platforms then. And if you're interested in checking out some songwriting or singing classes with me, just check out my website, eliconley.com. And I teach classes online, so I work with folks all over. And just big, big thank you to you, Alex. I am a fan of your podcast. I listen to it. And so it's such a treat to get to be on here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my God. You're so welcome. I'm such a fan of your music. So this is like, you know, a very happy, very happy episode. Yay. For me. I'm so glad that you were like, yeah, totally, let's do this. Yeah, so I will put your website on the episode description as well, but dear listeners and now viewers as well, because the podcast is also on YouTube, you can go and follow Eli right now on the, any streaming platform, right? Spotify or wherever people listen to their music. They can probably find your past music as they get ready for your beautiful new album, which will be released on July 14th. So very shortly. Thank you so much again for being on the podcast and making the time.
My pleasure. I appreciate you. Have a great rest of your day.